Welcome to Issues and Ideas. Coming up on today's program, correspondent Tom Wilmer takes us on a Christmas train trip around the country, riding the Polar Express through the Verde Canyon, Grand Canyon, and Branson Scenic Railways. Also, Ears on Art presents part two of its 14th annual holiday program, featuring touching, funny, and unique stories told by members of our community. This year's theme is The Gift is in the Details. Up first, though, Tom Wilmer explores the history of Letitia Winery, celebrating its 30th anniversary.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Arroyo Grande, California. Right now, we're in the hills outside of town at a beautiful winery estate called Letitia. Letitia dates from 1982, when it first opened as Maison Dutz, a champagne house that came from France. Right now, we're with Eric Hakey, who is the winemaker and president at Letitia today. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here with you.
It's great to be here. Always a treat. Such a beautiful setting. Panoramic view. I don't know how you get any work done.
It's tough. Someone's got to do it, though. Yeah.
Going back in time, I remember 30 years ago when Maison Dutz came here. Wow, this French champagne house is coming to Arroyo Grande. Tell us what happened. Why did they target here?
Yeah, it was pretty special. 30 years ago, they came over as a very well-established champagne house, and they wanted to find a location that could replicate what they were doing back there as best as possible, and in particular when it comes to very cool climates.
Terroir was their real focus then.
Yes, it was. And looking back at the research that they did, you could see that they went up and down through the Central Coast. They wanted to stay in the South rather than to be up in Napa with some of the other competitors. And so they did a lot of research trying to find locations that were very cold. And obviously, as you can see from today, being right next to the water, it's very cool here.
And again, the advantage of seeking out cool would be longer hang time and more control over your sugars. Would that be the driver?
That is a big driver, yes. Of course, we don't get the really cold winters and the snow that they have in Champagne, but we do have very cool growing season. And what happens when you're making champagne or sparkling wine, as we have to call it here, you want to have your grapes carry a lot of acidity and crispness to them. And so when you grow in cool climates, inherently, the terroir takes over and your grapes have a higher acidity, more of that citrus green apple that you look for.
There are very few sparkling wine producers anywhere on the Central Coast.
Yeah, we're about it as far as any size goes. Of course, there's some of our friends are making small amounts here and there, but as far as a commercial winery, and as you mentioned earlier, for them coming over in the early 80s, it was unique to have someone focus specifically on sparkling wine, and that's all that they did. We were not making any still wines at the time, so it was quite a big deal.
First, I have a question. Why is it that so many of the sparkling wines that you see come from Lodi, come from the valley and not the coast?
I would say when you see those types of wines, they're usually of a lower price point, and certainly a different quality. And because sparkling wine is actually very expensive to make, and when I say sparkling, I'm talking about the champagne method, the true
méthode champenois.
Yeah, true méthode champenois. It's very difficult, and it is very expensive to make.
For the listener, explain the difference between méthode champenois and Charmat.
Méthode champenois, by definition, is that the wine has had a second fermentation in the actual bottle that you would be drinking. So you harvest the grapes and it goes through the primary fermentation like all wines do. But then when we bottle it, we put a little bit of sugar and yeast in with that wine and it ferments again in the bottle, which is very risky when you get down to it from a winemaking standpoint. But that's what gives you your bubbles and that toastiness and that richness that you find in sparkling wine or champagne.
Okay. Tell the listener the secret of the bubbles. I love that story, how to tell visually good champagne from the Charmat process.
Well, the good champagne, or certainly wine that's gone through méthode champenois, has very refined bubbles that travel up through the center of your glass.
Straight little lines.
And a straight little beautiful bead that's very, very pretty and very attractive. And it also adds to the mousse or the finesse of the wine when it's in your mouth. Now, the Charmat method appears more like you would see a glass of 7-Up or Soda Pop, in that the CO2 has been injected and it tends to sit around the glass itself rather than coming up through the wine.
And again, this is a process of time. where in the Charmat it's injected and can have bubbles in a day.
That is correct. We mentioned the finesse and the expense of making sparkling wine. True Method Champenoise, it's because it stays around so long. We have to hold our Brut Cuvée, our basic wine, we hold for 24 months before we release it. Some of our vintage wines are 3, 4, 5 years before we ever release them. And that adds again to the richness of the wine, and you see those bubbles become even more refined over time.
Another fascinating aspect is riddling. Tell us about that. That's incredibly labor-intensive.
Yeah, so after you've fermented again in the bottle, of course you have all of this sediment in there, and you need to get that out. And so there's a process that's as old as making champagne tradition, is to take the bottle and put it in a rack that tilts the bottle upside down, and through a process of little twists and little turns, known as riddling, that sediment falls down into the neck of the bottle, and then you're able to extract that through what we call a disgorging process.
I remember a time not that long ago when rosé wines in general, the joke was rosé non grata.
Yeah, it was very real. And it's still out there a little bit, and that's the problem that we have, is people think that all rosés are white Zinfandel sometimes, and that they're just going to be sweet and not very exciting wines. But obviously the world is changing, and people realize that there's some fabulous rosés.
So people are getting in. They're understanding that when you hear the name rosé, it might be something really awesome.
Yeah, more and more. And we see that when people come in the tasting room, and mm-hmm. you have those that say, oh, I don't want the rosé because it's sweet. And you say, no. So it's part of the education process, and it is definitely improving out there.
Tell us a little bit more about your sparkling wine before we move on.
All those sparkling wines are 100% Méthode Champenoise. And with this wine, 2009, obviously we've held it a little while on the tirage and stored it so it can really improve that richness and finesse. And so we're very proud to have this released right now, especially going into the holidays. It's a great wine for the holidays.
Well, before we move on from champagne, tell us about your production of champagne today, which now has become just a part of the whole.
Yeah, in its heyday, Maison Dutz was producing about 30,000 cases of sparkling wine only. And now we've changed gears. Of course, the ownership has changed over the years, and the focus has been directed more towards Pinot Noir and still wines, but we still make the sparkling wines. We make about 8,000 cases a year now. Mm-hmm. We've capped that program, again, because of our space and cellar constraints. We direct more of that space to the still wines, mm-hmm. barrels, etc.
Where are you targeting it from a price point?
On the sparkling wines, we average in the mid-20s to upper 20s. The Brut Cuvée, which we make the most of, is a $25 bottle of wine, and then when you go into our reserve tiers, they go above 30.
Tell us about how the shift and transformation took place, when and why, and as you alluded to, you today have become a specialist in Pinot Noir.
Well, yeah, the transition happened in the mid-90s. Roederer, a very famous champagne and sparkling wine maker, actually purchased Maison Dutz and Champagne Dutz and all of its entities. And at the time, they really didn't have a need for another sparkling wine house down here in the Central Coast. They had their project up north. And so between that and the leases going away on the land and some other complications, the winery was sold to the current owner, who bought it in 1998, and he wanted to take it in a different direction and really focus on Pinot Noir.
Was that kind of a transitional moment in the world of Pinot Noir on the Central Coast, which has become probably the premier growing area for Pinot in California?
Yeah, it was. Pinot Noir was really just starting to take off, and certainly we were ahead of the curve as far as the amount that we planted. It became quickly one of the largest estates of Pinot Noir, and now is one of the largest estates of Pinot Noir in California because of that aggressively pursuing the Pinot Noir, which again was just ahead of the curve before the sideways phenomenon took off a few years later and that sort of thing. So it was a bit visionary on the owner's part to go that direction.
Mm-hmm. Worked out well, didn't it?
It did. At the time, we were a little nervous, but but definitely worked out.
So there really is not an area in California that is superior, maybe Russian River a contender?
Yeah, I hate to say that one is better than the other. You know, it's all friendly competition when we get down to it.
I do know there are producers in the Santa Cruz Mountains who drive down here and pick up your grapes.
Yeah, absolutely. We are well established as a great area to grow Pinot Noir, and some of our neighbors we've all pioneered the Arroyo Grande area, Central Coast.
And a couple other names, who else would be in the forefront?
Well, you have some of the older producers. You have Albon Clément is just down the road, more of Santa Maria Valley. It's only 15 miles down the road. Of course, here specifically, Tally, just over the hill, they have very similar soils to us and climate, and they pioneered the region. And then as you go into San Luis Obispo, you have the Niven family that has been here for a long time, growing a lot of good Pinot Noir as well.
And speaking of growing, that's something that I didn't get at first, and I think a lot of people are not aware that you are as much or more a grower as you are a producer. Tell us about your acreage, and you sell a lot of grapes that you don't squish.
Yeah, that's right. Winemaking is farming. Sometimes we forget that, but being the size that we are, and it's all in the state and it's all ours, yes, we are farming it. We use about 75% of the grapes here on the ranch for our own production, and then we do sell some to some of our good friends, as we like to call them. And we have been recognized as a good location for quality, and we're very proud of that.
Give us some names of who might buy some of your grapes.
We've got, from the small side, Tantera has used our grapes for a long time. Lumines is a friend of ours who's a newer brand using the wines as well. One of the larger producers is Wild Horse, uses a bit.
Well, let's loop back to the history, because I remember years ago, your dad, he was here working away in the sparkling wine operation, and he's still here. You've grown up in this family operation, and here you are as winemaker. Tell us about the family, your dad.
Yeah, my dad, he's been here since the day it opened. He truly has the sparkling wine in his heart. You know, it's his baby. So I remember when my first harvest, I was his cellar rat out here digging out the presses and helping him with harvest. And so I grew up around it. Of course, got to learn some of the techniques of winemaking, and the winemaker that was here at the time also trained actually both of us. And when the time came in 98, when the owner bought the place, transitioned, my father took over the sparkling winemaking, and I took over the still winemaking, and we both cooperate with each other today.
A huge issue on the Central Coast, in California, in the West, in the world, has to do with environmental condition, water conservation, environmental issues, even electricity. Tell us, what are you doing proactively?
Well, we're very proactive. First of all, we're SIP certified, which is sustainable in practice. That relates to our farming, and there's some very tight regulations that we like to stick to, and part of that is water conservation. An interesting thing is all of the water that's used in the winery, in the cellar, we capture all of that, and we send it back out into the vineyard to be used as irrigation. It's very eco-friendly.
Do you have holding ponds?
Yes, we have holding ponds so that we can get those up to the water level that we want. The owner is very green-minded, and so he puts that on us as well. So we take it very serious, because these days water obviously is a big issue. Mm-hmm. And we try to conserve as much as we can.
How about from electricity? Any thoughts on solar panel and minimizing?
Yeah, we've done a lot of research on solar panels, and we haven't quite committed to it. The expense up front is a little bit tough to swallow, but we are looking to expand the winery, and the new expansion does include the use of solar.
Yeah, let's talk about my favorite, the owl boxes, and the beneficial insects. My favorite, the minute pirate bug.
That's all good stuff. Yeah, the owls are very important. You know, we have a lot of rodents that attack the vines, the roots in particular, and owls are, let's just say, very efficient at helping to remove some of that. So we put up owl boxes, which are bird homes all over the ranch for them to live in, and we encourage that. Also, part of our sustainability program is to plant cover crop in between the rows that create an environment for what we call the beneficial insects, your favorite, to live and to thrive and to be a part of that eco-community in the vine and the vineyard. It's very important. Also, we've taken on the last 2 years, we're looking at, for bird control, using raptors. So we use falconers out here, and to good success, actually. It's been quite good for us.
Do you still have to do some netting in the fall?
A little bit. We have some areas that are a little bit close to trees, so the falcons have a hard time managing those, so we net the perimeters. But the majority of the ranch, we were able to use falconers this year.
That's awesome, and it worked.
It does. It really works. The birds are gone.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. It's been an absolute pleasure visiting with you, Eric. Thank you so much.
Tom, likewise. Always a pleasure.
We've been visiting with Eric Hickey, the winemaker and president at Leticia Winery in Arroyo Grande, California.
And you're listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Still to come on today's show, Ears on Art presents part two of its 14th annual holiday program, which features touching, funny, and unique stories told by members of our community. But up first, correspondent Tom Wilmer now takes us on a Christmas train trip around the country.
Whenever I travel around America, one of my favorite activities is to ride the rails, specifically historic train rides. And the bonus is when the cars are pulled by huffing and puffing steam engines.
All aboard! All aboard!
The 2004 Tom Hanks movie, Polar Express, lives on today as a Christmastime theme aboard numerous historic railways across America. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me as we ride the historic rails aboard the Verde Canyon Railway not far from Sedona, Arizona, where we'll learn about the railway's history and, of course, their Santa Claus Express.
Santa Claus comes on and sings in every car and reads the Christmas story to all the kids, and there's free hot chocolate and cookies to go with.
Then we'll hop over to the Grand Canyon and board the historic Grand Canyon Railway, where we'll learn about their Polar Express Christmastime excursions.
We get to the North Pole, Santa's there, the train pulls past, and then he gets on the train and walks through the train and hands out bells to all the children. Just a real magical experience.
And then it's time to board the Branson Scenic Railway in Missouri.
Right now we have them decorated for the Polar Express.
Verde Valley, situated in northern Arizona, a short hop from Sedona and Flagstaff. Come along and join us in Verde Valley, where we board the Verde Canyon Railroad for a leisurely ride through rugged Red Rock Canyons as we visit with Amber Saravo, the first class supervisor aboard Verde Canyon Railroad. The Verde Canyon Railway offers a memorable four-hour round trip through some of the most spectacular Red Rock Canyons in Arizona. Amber Saravo.
My name is Amber Saravo, and I am the first-class supervisor at the Verde Canyon Railroad.
Excellent. Tell us about the history of the railroad and what it is today.
Well, the railroad started in 1912. It was originally for the mines in Jerome, and General Clark started the railroad. And after the mines closed in the 1950s, the railroad kind of stopped for a little while, and then the cement plant opened here in Clarkdale, Arizona, and we started hauling all the freight for the cement plant. And Dave Gerbano bought the railroad, and mostly for freight. And when he realized what was out here in this canyon, he made it an excursion as well.
How often does the train run? Is it every day, twice a day?
Normally the train runs 6 days a week. Tuesday is our maintenance day, but it's kind of a seasonal thing. Summer times we do our night runs. Oktoberfest, of course, we'll do our double trains on the weekends. We do Santa Claus Express in December, and it's 3 days a week. And then January we run 2 days a week.
Oh, great. Tell us about the Santa Claus Express. That's great.
Santa Claus comes on and sings in every car and reads the Christmas story to all the kids, and there's free hot chocolate and cookies to go with. Put on a great show.
Tell us about the itinerary. Where does the train go and what do you see?
Well, we start in Clarkdale, Arizona, and we go to Perkinsville. And Perkinsville is an old mining star, the old train stop, and back when it was a steam locomotive. And now when it switched to diesel locomotive, the town kind of died off because we didn't need it anymore. It's still owned by the same family for almost 100 years, and we stop there, and people get to see the old town and where how the West Was Won was filmed and where our depot started for about 3 minutes. And then we come back through the Verde Canyon, and really the ride is mostly for what you see out here. So you kind of get the same Sedona sights without all the people, and you don't have to drive. We do it for you.
It's outside of Cottonwood, which is outside of Sedona and Flagstaff, so it's approachable and close to a lot of places in central Arizona then.
We get people from all over the world, and we get repeat riders from Arizona. They come up here with families, and we host all kinds of special events, weddings, whatever you need. We're pretty good at putting on whatever kind of show you want.
Mm-hmm. And you can rent the caboose, right, for your family and friends?
The caboose is great. It's at $600, up to six people, and it's beautiful. It's mahogany wood, built-in lighting, all stem glassware, one person taking care of you. Pretty much it's your own car for the whole trip. Beautiful, beautiful ride.
And then you have regular coach class and first class cars.
Yes, we have the coach class cars, and it's more like bus style seating with flip seats. And then first class is more like lounge style seating with a full cash bar and hors d'oeuvres and a champagne cider toast upon boarding.
Round trip journey is how long?
4 hours round trip, 20 miles up, 20 miles back, so 40 miles. But we only go 12 miles an hour, so it takes about 4 hours. But it's great for picture taking.
For further information, website?
At verdecanyonrr.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Tom Wilmer reporting from Grand Canyon, Arizona. Right now we're on the Grand Canyon Railway. Please join us as we visit with Derek Turner, an employee and the regional sales manager with the Grand Canyon Railway. Hi, Derek. Tell us a little bit about the history of the railroad.
This railroad took its first passengers up to the Grand Canyon on September 17th, 1901, which at the time, the premier way to get to the canyon was the stagecoach. Would have taken maybe 8 hours from Flagstaff to take a stagecoach. Took 3 hours on train from Williams, so the fact that a person could get on a train, it actually costs less to ride the train up to the Grand Canyon, and it took 3 hours. Now it takes 2 hours and 15 minutes, so pretty close to the same amount of time. It became a pretty nice luxury, and at one point it was the primary means of getting to the Grand Canyon was taking the train. So we took more people to the canyon than anyone else, by stagecoach, by horse, by buggy, any other means. The Grand Canyon Railway was the primary way to get there. As time went on, the automobile became more popular, and less people took the train. So the late 60s was when we took our final passengers. The Grand Canyon Railway still would use the tracks, would take water. It was used at some point for transporting livestock, and ranchers would use it as well. And then a couple out of Scottsdale, Arizona, Max and Thelma Biegert, had a vision for it. They bought the line from the Santa Fe Railroad Company and restored it. It was 1989, September 17th, on the anniversary of the first passengers in 1901. Had a vision, bought some cars from different parts around the country, and set some terrible goal of having everything up and running by September 17th, 1989. They did it. As a kid, I was still in middle school at the time, grew up in Williams, where the train departs from, and was there getting free hot dogs and balloons when this big steam engine and old 1923 Harriman-style cars left out of the depot for the first time. I think on that very day it broke down, but they stuck with it, and they kept investing and reinvesting, put a lot of time and effort. One of our engines right now, engine 4960, Max personally put $1.5 million into the restoration of that one engine. And now today, we take over 250,000 passengers in a year. We have several specialty programs like the Polar Express, which is also really popular. It took 76,000 people in the Polar Express last year.
That's Christmas time. That's special. Christmas. Tell us what happens on the Polar Express.
The Polar Express is phenomenal. We turn our depot in Williams into a wintry wonderland. After our regular train gets back, we pull in the Polar Express, which again has those 1923 Harriman-style cars. So it's the same cars that are featured in the book and in the movie. We're using the same coach cars. We have all of our depot, our hotel, our restaurant decorated up with lights. We also partner with the city of Williams to turn Williams into a real Christmas city. The train then pulls into the depot. You'll see families out there, kids from 2 to 92, all dressed in pajamas. They all get on the train. The train goes about 30 minutes up the tracks, and along the way we read the book. We sing Christmas carols. We serve hot chocolate and cocoa, and all of our attendants are in their chef uniforms. And then we get to the North Pole, which we've constructed right on the side of the track. So it's middle of the night. At least it feels like it is. It's all dark. We're out in the country, and we're at 7,000 feet elevation. So if it's clear, there's more stars than you've ever seen in your life. If it's snowy, there's snow coming down, and it's just perfect. We get to the North Pole. Santa's there. The train pulls past, and then he gets on the train and walks through the train and hands out bells to all the children, similar to the book. Just a real magical experience. That's one of the special events we do here.
And how would somebody find out about the Polar Express, say they were coming through Arizona at Christmas time?
The best way, I would say, is our website. We have a whole section on our website, which is www.thetrain.com. And there is a button there for special events and Polar Express, and you'll see pricing. We run it now from November through the third week of January because it's become so popular, and we do two trains a night, just about every night during that time. So
we've been speaking with Derek Turner, Regional Sales Manager with the Grand Canyon Railway. Thank you, Derek.
Thank you very much.
Now let's head over to Branson, Missouri, and climb aboard the Branson Scenic Railroad.
My name is Vic Mitchell. We have two runs that we make from the Branson Depot. Right now we're on the south route and we're going into Arkansas. Both routes last an hour and 45 minutes. And we'll probably get in about nine and a half miles into Arkansas, stop on a trestle, and then return to the depot in our time allocated.
Tell us about the rolling stock. This is some great historic cars.
Oh, yeah. We have quite a few vintage cars. We have seven, actually. Cars range from 1939, built by the Budd Company in Pennsylvania. Another car that was a 1947 model. We have another one that's a 1949. We have two built in 1952. And then we have two built in 1956.
And then you have your Sky Dome cars.
Twin Sky Dome cars, 1952 models, and then we have a 1947 Sky Dome. So love those cars. We take a lot of pride in them.
Well, they're still quite elegant and beautiful, aerodynamic and streamlined. And
right now we have them decorated for the Polar Express.
Tell us about the Polar Express. This is kids special.
Yeah, we have a lot of kids that'll be on, their parents or and or grandparents. We've seen all ages come on board, and many of them choose to wear pajamas like the movie. They have a great time. We play the music and we do the roles that the film had for everybody. The only thing we don't do is dance on the ceiling like they did in the movie. But other than that, things are just the way it was.
Tell us about some of the highlights of things that somebody would see.
Well, we have a lot of rolling hills and short mountains, and then we're going to go through two tunnels today. One is two-thirds of a mile long. Another one is one-half a mile long. Then we have a couple trestles that we'll be going over. One is 113 feet above a creek. Another one is 122 feet above a wide valley. A beautiful scene of the Ozarks.
For further information, is
BransonTrain.com. The northern route we didn't talk yet about. It kind of circles Branson a little bit, see some of the stars' homes, and then straight north into the Reed Springs Galena area. It's a very scenic area as well. You'd be surprised the number of people that have never been on a train. Many of the little kids, you know, think it's just absolutely wonderful. Their eyes light up all the time. My name is Vic Mitchell, and I'm the conductor.
Thank you, Vic.
Yes.
And this is Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX, serving South Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being. Krista Tippett talks with social researcher Brené Brown. Her work on vulnerability and courage shook the perfectionistic ground beneath her feet. What she's learned is now persuading millions to reconsider the way they succeed and fail, parent, and navigate relations with the opposite sex. That's On Being, coming up at 2 o'clock here on KCBX. But up next on Issues and Ideas, Ears on Art presents part two of its 14th annual holiday program featuring stories told by members of our community. Ears on Art is sponsored by Marshall's Jewelers, creating and selling fine jewelry since 1889. You can visit them on the corner of Hygera and Garden Streets in downtown San Luis Obispo. This is Public Radio KCBX.
From San Francisco to Connecticut, from storytellers to benefactors, we continue with our holiday stories. Stay tuned. Hi, I'm Stephen DeLuca, and this segment of Issues and Ideas is Ears on Art, produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX, serving the California Central Coast from Salinas to Ventura. Today, we continue with Chapter 2 of the 2013 Holiday Stories, written and recited by local residents.
Thanks, Stephen. I am Chrissy Hewitt. Remember the book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, and Everything is the Small Stuff? Well, it never sat well with me, even though I understood the concept of setting priorities. Our theme, The Gift is in the Details, is dedicated to the idea that it is in those nooks and crannies where the richness of life takes its form. Here now is story number one.
Hi, my name is Rachel Yan. I am an artist and I live in Los Osos, California. Daddy the Prankster. Always when he told my brother and me a story or wild tale, Daddy, when we least expected it, would turn into the monster or wild tiger of his story. He would snarl and growl. He would drop to his hands and knees and chase us across the room. Our response was to scream with laughter and beg for a piggyback ride. At this holiday season, I think of Daddy. His enthusiasm knew no bounds. On the particular Christmas Eve that I remember so fondly, Santa Claus in full regalia came to visit. My brother Dan must have been 3, I was 5. It was our family's habit to sit around the fireplace taking turns telling stories. The coziness on those winter nights I can never forget. There had been a light snow that year. The night sky was luminous. Our Christmas tree had been hauled into the house and decorated for at least a week. Though my mother was usually in the kitchen putting finishing touches on the feast to come, she had joined us at the fireside. My 4 older siblings, as well as Mama, seemed to have an air of hushed expectancy. Only in retrospect did I realize this. Danny Boy and I, perhaps for the 100th time, touched our stockings all hung in a row. Once more, we were assured that come Christmas morning, they would be filled. These stockings were our winter knee-highs. In 1940, no fancy Christmas stockings were available. Without warning, there was a ruckus on our front porch, stomping and stamping, and a deep roar of ho, ho, ho filled the crisp air. Danny Boy and I dove into the comfort of our mother's embrace. We looked into each other's eyes, too frightened to speak. A loud knock, knock, knock at the door, and then our small farmhouse was filled with a larger-than-life figure. He was dressed all in red with white fur trimmings. His long, flowing beard almost covered his rosy cheeks. We were awestruck by his large black boots and his loud, deep voice. He was so powerful in the image that my brother and I could only bear tiny, reticent glances at him. "I came to see if you have been good children," said Santa in a strict voice. As he spoke, he tried to pass each of us a candy cane. We dared not respond, but closed our eyes and hid our heads in Mama's ample apron. Santa put his finger to the side of his nose and rose up from his squat. He disappeared through the front door. We heard the tinkle-tinkle of sleigh bells and Merry Christmas growing fainter and fainter. The grown-ups wanted to see what Danny Boy and I would have to say about this magical happening. Neither of us could speak. Finally, our mother called bedtime. Our opportunity to respond was over. Many details of my father's shenanigans come back to me these 70-plus years later. He was often the butt of his own jokes. In his old age, his college-aged grandchildren would bring their friends to visit him just for the pleasure of hearing Daddy's fanciful tales. I know that in the scheme of things, my father would never make the cut of successful. He toiled relentlessly on our farm, my mother's inheritance from her Mayflower-era family. He loved inventions. Once he spent an inordinate amount of time on an anti-boll weevil contraption. It never worked. The play equipment he made for my brother and me was much more successful. We had a split oak swing, a seesaw, and a merry-go-round, or flying Jenny, that could take your breath away. When it snowed in South Carolina, we had barrel-stave skis and ski poles made of pine saplings. If I could speak to Daddy today, I would be able to say to him that the way he lived his life has been a blueprint for the way I live my life.
Hi, I'm Barb Renshaw. I live in Los Osos, California. In my career, I worked as an engineer, but now I do botanical illustration. This story is about my grandmother in the earthquake of 1906 in San Francisco. The earth roared, the house rocked. I gripped my pillow and put it over my head. The shaking seemed to last forever. Furniture, lamps, dishes scattered and crashed. It stopped and then began again. Mother shouted, "We should go to the park." Our houseboy, Way, said, "Let me go outside to see if it's safe." Way came back in, looking grim. "I see fires. We hurry now." Mother directed everyone to bring coats, scarves, and other items for warmth. Way and Father took blankets and a tarp. Father cautioned us not to bring anything extra because the walk would be long and difficult. The house looked as if dynamite had exploded near us. We now saw the fires through the windows. "The city will be consumed," my father said as he walked beside me. "What will the people do?" I asked. "Rebuild," he said. Rubble filled the streets. People wailed and ran away from the buildings and the fires. Way and my father shepherded us through the chaos, not letting me, cook, or mother out of their sight. When we entered Golden Gate Park, we joined throngs of people of all kinds, jumbled together, looking for safe places away from anything that might fall or burn. The earth rumbled again. We stopped and sat on the ground. Way addressed Father. "Sir, I go ahead and find place?" Father nodded. A few minutes later, Way came back and pointed toward a grove of shrubs and small trees. "Over there." We followed him into the grove where we discovered a couple of benches. Father told us to sit there while he sought information. When Father returned, he tried to reassure us. "We will stay here only until we can find transportation to Paso Robles." Way asked, "Shall I go back to get supplies?" "Good idea," said Father. I wanted to go with Way, but Father wouldn't have it. "Chrissy, you must stay here with the others to keep control of our space and benches. I have to negotiate for transportation." Way disappeared through the shrubbery. He was gone a long time, but then he reappeared with a great bundle on his back. He gently set the bundle on the ground between our benches and opened it. "I bring food, pans, dishes, and other things." He spread a tarp and arranged our possessions under a tree. Next to the pots and pans, we saw the 12 small Chinese plates Way gave us as a gift a few months before. Way had worked for the family for years, and last year he asked for permission to return to China to visit his former home. When he returned, he presented the plates to us as a thank you gift. I love these plates for their intricate design of flowers, butterflies, and curlicues. The plates have no identification on them, no indication of who made them or where they were made. I knew someone painted them by hand with tiny brushes. I sat on the bench in the park and thought about China. I hoped someday I could go there myself. Years later, I inherited the Chinese plates. I like to serve dessert on them. Now that I am old, I will give the plates to my eldest daughter. She knows the story, and so does her daughter. Each in turn will serve dessert on the plates and pass them on.
If you have just tuned in, you are listening to Ears on Art, produced at the studios of KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo. This is the second installment of our annual holiday stories, and here is co-host Krissa Hewitt with her story.
It's gone. I had been given a warning a couple of days before, but this email announcement of its destruction hit me like a ton of bricks. The "it" here refers to a house. Over 20 years ago, after my aunt's death, it was sold to a couple who today are in need of building it anew. A very good thing that the wood, stone, and plaster that filled the dumpsters did not, could not, include the experiences and the memories. This summer home belonged to my father's sister and her husband, Aunt Kate and Uncle Bob. It was located in Giants Neck, Connecticut, and was situated on a stone wall overlooking the Long Island Sound. This home away was 3,000 miles from my family home in the San Fernando Valley, and despite the relatively short time intervals spent inside its walls, it is known to me like the back of my hand. From age 2 to 7, the visits were measured in days each summer. When I was 8, we stayed 2 months. During that time, my father was diagnosed, operated on, and died of lung cancer. Over the years, I paid visits when my travels took me east, but it was in the early 50s that the impact of this place took shape. To this day, I chuckle at it being referred to as a cottage, as it was a 2-story house with 5 bedrooms and 4 bathrooms. But it was no McMansion. To us, it was just known as the Shore. For this young child, it was a place of people, sights, sounds, odors, experiences, and rituals that were so foreign that I seemed to absorb them like a sponge. Say what we might about America being a melting pot, California is not New England. As much as he loved his family, my father's need was to move cross-country after college, mid-1920s. Later, once he had a family, most returns were limited to yearly short summer visits. I loved arriving in Connecticut. I was full of anticipation as we made the turn onto the long road taking us through the trees to the shore, finally seeing the water and then driving under the railroad tracks. The concrete block walls created a distinctive sound against the passing of the car. Another long block and we would make it to the driveway. This maybe is where cottage comes in. This house had no formal front door. We made our way out the garage back door, past the outdoor shower, and up the few steps to the small walkway that ended at the most used entrance. Entering, we were in perhaps a sand room versus a mud room, complete with refrigerator, coat, towel, and bathing cap hooks. From there, turning left, we were in the kitchen. There is not time here to describe the floor plan, but as a little girl, the stairs were a total fascination. To my parents, aunt, and grandmother, my constant need to go up and down was an ongoing nightmare. I grew out of this, but was reminded often enough. The cast of characters consisted of Aunt Kate, Uncle Bob, my cousins Avery and Sandy, my grandmother, and my family, father, mother, sister, brother, and me. There are stories about each, but my focus here will be on Aunt Kate and Grandma. These two were Connecticut Yankees through and through. As a kid, I did not know what that meant, but I did know that they each presented a world to me that was most different from what California offered. The family love I understood. The structure and level of formality, I did not. For Aunt Kate, breakfast was not finished before the day was fully planned. The projected number of swims, what excursion was to happen, Mystic Seaport, Old Lyme, Niantic for food and banking, what guests might be coming, what would be for dinner, or would this be the night we went to Sweden House for the smorgasbord? One of the morning rituals was making the list for the necessary purchases from the Viking bakery truck. Our California breakfast table was not set with donuts, and there was no hinged metal bread box on the kitchen counter filled with hermit cookies and coffee cake. For Aunt Kate, the daily swims were the most important thing in her summer life. By age 7, I was a good enough swimmer that I could join her for the pre-breakfast dip. For the most part, the majority of the household preferred to sleep in or just avoid the cold water. We would grab a towel and a bathing cap, round the house, descend the stairs, and cross the narrow beach of coarse sand to the big, smooth rock which marked the entry path into the water. I will forever see her bending over to pick up unwanted stones that the current had delivered to the sandy walkway she worked so hard daily to maintain. Without straightening up, she would toss the offender to the side to join the others. Any who swam were expected to join in this ritual. From her, I learned to enter cold water back first, as these nerves are less sensitive. Pre-lunch and afternoon swims lasted longer, and when the tide was out, there was a wonderful sandbar where the water was just waist deep. She would purchase a new suit now and then, but the style never changed. These were one piece and had a short skirt that started at the waist and ended just below the panty line. The bathing cap was white. Although she laughed till her eyes watered, life was about doing things properly. She played games to win. Actually, she played everything to win. This was accompanied by a generosity and helpfulness that were ever present and tireless. Bridge, double-deck solitaire, a game of manipulation, cards were her thing. A deck in her hands was just a beautiful extension, a seamless motion of shuffling, dealing, sorting the cards, and playing the right one. All of this was accented by the large collection of silver bangle bracelets that adorned her arm and added wonderful sound to her fluid movement. Those bracelets, perhaps a hint that there was a woman inside wishing to break the mold of her well-disciplined upbringing? Competition was always in the air, but so was her love. My grandmother must have taken grandma classes. She was the only grandparent alive during my lifetime. She did her job to the nth degree. I would often rise before others were awake, and she was welcoming as I would paddle down the hall and climb into her bed. She was the best storyteller. Many of these were about her or my father as children. But sometimes we would be amused by the fly on the ceiling or talk about the duck pond outside her window. She talked with her hands, especially her fingers, adding depth to the stories. Hanging from her white, iron-framed headboard was an air raid whistle. It hung there almost as a dare. Over the years, giving it a blow was seldom on the agenda. Next to her bed was always a bowl of fruit, and in her dresser drawer was a jar of Roosevelt dimes, a means of keeping them out of circulation, I'm told. In the bathroom was the glass that held her dental bridges. And on her dresser was a jewelry box and an array of bead necklaces. She adored anything that we presented to her. My regular activity was searching for very tiny shells. Her favorite adjective was cunning, as in adorable. Because of the position of the coastline, the sun did set over the water, even though this was the Atlantic. She adored sitting outside, watching the colors of the sky or the sailboats at sea. We counted freight cars on the trains that were visible from where we sat. We fed ducks almost every day using bread she properly saved for this purpose. We played cards all the time, and she taught us how to shuffle the deck. I don't know if she ever went in the ocean, but she was always there to hear our stories when we returned from wherever we had been. As she became older, she sometimes chose to stay home when we were headed out for errands or sightseeing. She would hand us crisp dollar bills to cover what she thought we might want. I'm not sure what engendered her love of new bills, but she always had them. She most certainly did not flaunt wealth. She just adored giving. Back in California, her Christmas box was always the last thing we opened. We learned to look closely because pockets always contained treats, from silver dollars to mystic seaport candy sticks. This game of hide-and-seek certainly spoiled us, as to this day, opening packages has never been quite the same. This story could go on and on. I doubt that I was ever able to tell either of these two women what they taught me. Not sure I can adequately do it now. You don't really know when it happens or what it means. Somewhere along the way, you just know that your life has been forever changed as a result of these gifts. It has never been my desire to live in Connecticut, but when I cross the state line, see the summer vegetation, smell the air, something in me knows that I am home.
Hello, this is Stephen DeLuque. I first met Clifford Chapman in August of 1981. My husband Jeff had started working at Marshall's Jewelers, which Clifford owned, in July of that year. Clifford was friends with William Clark, a rancher from the Creston area who was serving in the Reagan administration as Assistant Secretary of Defense. Clark had been instrumental in securing entry into the United States for Maxim and Dmitri Shostakovich, son and grandson, respectively, of the famed Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich Sr., who had faced persecution and censorship under Stalin's regime and later under future communist regimes. The Shostakoviches were fleeing the former Soviet Union and, in gratitude, asked Mr. Clark what they could do to thank him for his involvement. What resulted was a concert with the San Luis Obispo Symphony. Longtime family friend Mislav Rostropovich, himself in exile, who at the time was the conductor of the U.S. National Orchestra, came along to participate. Clifford had purchased tickets to the concert for all of his employees and their partners. The concert was powerful and memorable. I memorialized it with a series of intaglio monoprints to commemorate the evening. Thus was my introduction to the generosity and benevolence of Clifford Chapman. Clifford and his partner Don lived on an impressive estate in Shell Beach. Every October, he hosted an open house for the customers and friends of Marshall's Jewelers. Upwards of 3,000 people would attend the afternoon event, an event that would allow attendees an opportunity to dress in their finery. And dress they did. The open house was manned by family, friends, and employees of the store. Being in food service at the time, I was glad to help out. The day before the event, all the help gathered at the house to manicure the 2 acres of grounds, sweep, wash windows, and do whatever else was required. The ground floor of the main house was also open to the attendees and was manned accordingly. Champagne and coffee was served, along with salted nuts and, In the early years, pumpkin candy made by Clifford's mother, Rose, from pumpkins grown on the property. In later years, the pumpkin candy was replaced with fruitcake. I remember one year my birthday fell on the day before the open house. Jeff had told me that they were short-handed at the house and Clifford would need my help. So from 8 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, I washed windows, swept walks, hauled tables and chairs, and set up umbrellas. It was all a ruse to get me out of the house, for Jeff had hired a caterer to prepare a 6-course meal for us and 8 guests. I didn't have a clue. After the last of the guests were escorted off the property, for no one wanted to leave, the gates were locked. After the dishes and glasses were washed and put away, and the tables and chairs secured, it was time for the helpers to relax and enjoy supper, which Clifford had prepared. After a couple of years, and because of my involvement in the hospitality industry, Clifford asked Jeff and me to organize the help for the open house, a responsibility we assumed until 1999, the last year that Marshalls had sponsored the open house. It was the 90th anniversary of the store, and although Clifford would allow us to continue the use of the property despite the fact that he had sold the store to Jeff in 1993, Clifford had started sponsoring more and more events at the house. There was the Afternoon of Epicurean Delights to benefit Planned Parenthood, and concerts for the Mozart Festival. Dinners and brunches, the food of which Clifford cooked and we helped serve, to raise money for the San Luis Obispo Symphony and hospice partners. And then there were the Boys and Girls Clubs. The list of organizations that Clifford allowed to use the property grew every year. Not to mention the private parties on July 4th and Christmas Eve for over 100 guests. Jeff and I felt, although Clifford strenuously argued the contrary, that one more event was an unnecessary intrusion into Clifford's and Don's time. For you see, much of the preparation for these numerous events was done by the two of them, and the tables, chairs, and umbrellas were at the house for whoever needed to use them. Clifford was a self-made man, born and raised in Guadalupe, his father an invalid and his mother a cook in a school cafeteria. He learned at an early age to help as many people as you can. His motto was not to step on people as you climb the ladder of success, but to bring as many people with you as you could. Clifford died on June 15, 2012, at the age of 82, far too soon for most of us, but his legacy remains. Clifford left his estate to the city of Pismo Beach so that it can continue to be used to raise funds and host events. A gift that will keep on giving into perpetuity. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I would like to thank today's fellow storytellers, Rachel Yon and Barb Renshaw, and of course, all of last week's storytellers. This has been Ears on Art's second chapter of the 2013 edition of Holiday Stories. Ears on Art is produced at KCBX Public Radio Studios on California's Central Coast. I am Stephen DeLuque, wishing all of our listeners a glorious holiday season.